everybody. I'm Scott, and welcome to the Shelfware Podcast. Today we've got part one of probably two podcasts where we're going to talk about the Hyperion Cantos, which is four novels written by Dan Simmons. But in this part, we're going to talk about Hyperion, which is book one, and The Fall of Hyperion, which is book two. And to help me do that is a guy that I read these books with, excellent booktuber named Noah, and his booktube channel is called Everyone Who Reads Must Converse. Hello, Noah, and welcome.
Hey there, Scott. Thanks for having me on, man. I tell you, I really enjoyed the read along with this and the discussions as we were going with it, and can't wait to get into this right tonight.
Absolutely, absolutely. So real quick, just quickly about yourself. Your channel name is a riff on Flannery O'Connor.
That's right. It's Everyone Who Reads It Must Converse. Just syllables and the way that the first letters work out is a play on Everything That Rises Must Converge. It's one of my favorite Flannery O'Connor short stories. And, nice. You know, I started the channel. I'm coming up on a year now. January 1st will be my year. And you know, you kind of want to think of a cool name, a catchy name, or something like this. And there's so many little puns used already. And I wasn't watching a whole lot of booktube before. So I just started thinking about things that I love, and I couldn't get away from Flannery O'Connor. And then so it just popped in my head, and I went with it.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. So you know that I do another podcast called A Good Story Is Hard to Find.
That's right.
Which is another riff on Flannery O'Connor. So.
That's right.
Yeah. So the first time I saw that channel name, I knew that we had something going on.
That's right. She's such a powerful writer.
She sure is. She sure is. And so is Dan Simmons. So, So I think what we'll do here is we'll talk about Hyperion and the Fall of Hyperion in a spoiler-free way. We're just going to do a quick review. So those of you who are listening who have not read this, we're going to talk about it in a way that won't ruin anything for you. And then we'll be sure to let you know when we're about to head into spoiler territory, because there's a lot of things to talk about in this book. And then to give you a chance to stop listening and to go read the books if you want to before you hear us talk about them.
And what you're saying, I mean, a lot to talk about is like putting it the mildest way possible. This is the most complex sci-fi series that I've ever read, the most complex sci-fi story.
That's awesome. Including Dune?
It's mind-blowing.
Including Dune?
Oh yeah, including Dune.
No kidding, that's awesome.
Very, very much including Dune, I would say, because, you know, in Frank Herbert, the AI question is not a question. There's not all these different societies and stuff like that. There's just human beings, and it's just human societies, and it's bigger and it's more expansive. But it's not as complex as what we're about to get in here. Let me tell you,
I love it. So I've read Dune and Dune Messiah. I haven't read the other four. It's hard not to compare this to Dune, isn't it?
It very much is.
Yeah, this was written right around 1989, the first volume, Hyperion, and Dune was 1960s, right?
Right. So, the first book is in the 60s.
Yeah, but this is definitely in that class, isn't it? I don't hear Hyperion talked about as much as I hear Dune talked about.
Of course. Oh yeah. I mean, you know, Hyperion is kind of mitigated to a smaller group of sci-fi heads, and I think we'll get a little bit more into that once we're, you know, done talking with about the other two, the Hyperion Cantos as a whole.
Okay.
Just because, you know, but some of the reasons for that are going to be touched on here, I think, just because it's themes and it's veins that run throughout the whole Hyperion Cantos.
Yeah. So the first thing I'd say about Hyperion, as I thought about it, was there is so much science fiction ideas in here. It's almost as if this is like a super mature science fiction novel that has taken like everything that came before it and put it into one book, you know, with and then some, right? And I should say at the outset too, is I consider Hyperion, the first volume, as a masterpiece. I feel like it's flawless. I've read it a couple times, and I just absolutely love it.
Yeah, completely amazing. And I mean, it's the structure is so good. Mm-hmm. And Dan Simmons has obviously done his share of reading and experiencing great sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Also horror.
Yes.
And also literature.
Right.
Like just straight literature. I mean, he obviously loves John Keats, and not just John Keats, but mythology, you know, Greek mythology and, you know, spiritual texts. I mean, he's probably a student of mm-hmm. of the Torah and Judeo-Christian myth and legend as well.
Yes, agreed. So, so a synopsis of this book, as if we can do it justice. So where we're at, we're in the 29th century, I believe. There's a hegemony. Mankind is all over the place. You know, we were in tons of different worlds, and the technology has moved forward at the same time. You know, we have AIs, we have far casting, which means basically stepping through a gate and ending up somewhere else. Just incredible amounts of things. So, what the book is about is a group of, I think it was seven. Am I right? There's six stories. Right. I think seven pilgrims.
One's carrying a baby.
Right. You got it. So these seven are headed to the planet named Hyperion, and they're on a pilgrimage to see the Shrike. Now, the Shrike is some kind of a mysterious, sort of a supernatural, you know, some type of a thing that nobody fully understands, but it's got religious connotations and all this stuff. So these seven people are headed to the Shrike in order to basically get something or to try to solve a problem. They're on this pilgrimage. Every single one of them has a reason that they want to go see the Shrike.
Right.
How am I doing so far?
I think you're doing good. I would say that, you know, it's the structure of this thing that gives it its beauty in a big way. You know, before I read it, everybody was saying, well, it's, you know, like the Canterbury Tales, Chaucer.
Yeah.
And you know, I see that, but only in the loosest way. But what it is this group that they're going there the whole time, this first book, Hyperion, and it's a beautiful book. You learn a lot about, I mean, he does his awesome world building, which he does through the whole series, but only with one planet, Hyperion, which is the seminal planet anyways. But each of these pilgrims in turn tells their story, and their story is directly linked to the planet of Hyperion, some more loosely than others. And like you're saying, they have their own motivation for being on the pilgrimage there. But the pilgrimage itself is just this kind of, what do they say? They do the pilgrimage every 20 years.
Right.
They send a group.
This may be the last one, right? May be the last one, according to them, because there's some kind of a war going on.
Yeah, well, there's prophecies, because there's the Shrike Church. So the church, and the church is mysterious as well, because where are they getting their information of this Shrike if nobody knows what the Shrike is? And even some of them think that the Shrike's not even a real thing.
Right.
So this you know, there's a lot of mystery. There's a lot of mystery in the way that Dan Simmons delivers this entire story. And I like that it's the storytelling on a very high level.
Agreed.
He's delivering it as he wants. You're just forced to take it mm-hmm. as he gives it to you.
And what it reads like is a collection of six short stories.
Right.
Every one of them is almost like a different genre. Yeah, and all told in the first person.
Yeah.
But it's like six different people are writing stories. It's a remarkable achievement. And there's not a weak one in the lot. And,
there's not.
Yeah, and you said that people say that it's like Canterbury Tales in space. Clearly, Dan Simmons was going for that, or at least saw the connection, because part one is the priest's tale, the man who cried God. Part two is the soldier's tale, the war lovers. Part three is the poet's tale, Hyperion Cantos, Part four is The Scholar's Tale, The River Lethe's Taste is Bitter. And then part five is The Detective's Tale, which is called The Long Goodbye. And then part six is The Consul's Tale, Remembering Ciri, before Ciri existed. Is that where they got Ciri? Right. They both probably got it from the same place anyway. There's one of them that is probably the most emotionally affecting story to me that I've ever read, which is the one about Sol Weintraub and his daughter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So.
What a heart wrencher.
It is definitely a heart wrencher. But there you have
even,
it. So
even in this first book, you know, there's just all of the whole spectrum of emotion. And I wouldn't feel right in moving one step even further in this without mentioning how much horror there actually is in this sci-fi as well.
Okay.
The Shrike is just a scary thing, especially in the first two books here.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like the Shrike is such a wonderful unknown, just a death dealer. They call him the Lord of Pain.
Yeah,
the Lord of Time. Nobody knows the motivations to this thing. It seemingly can be anywhere within the compound of the time tombs on Hyperion at will, and has no care for the person, is just there to deal pain and death.
And it's one of those things, you know, when you encounter them in life that you simply can't understand the motivation whatsoever, and it's horrifying. It's like it's not even understandable. It's like it's beyond understanding according to these people at this time.
And horrifying in that psychological way for sure, but even in the physical way. I mean, that Shrike is metal blades on metal blades on metal blades, forearms, red eyes, bright red eyes. That's how we almost every time you meet the Shrike in the book, it's first is the gleaming metal. You hear the scraping of metal, or you see the red eyes.
Yeah. And every one of these pilgrims has a reason that they're going towards that thing. You know, they're not going away from that thing. They're going towards that thing because they believe that its power can help them.
Yes, sir. Well, and it touched on it in that first book. And I never really, you know, because it becomes something completely different. This is the last pilgrimage or whatever. But the legend is that the Shrike will kill the pilgrims until the last one. And then the last one gets a wish granted or something like that, right?
Right, right.
And of course, that, you know, nothing plays out like that in this one. This is not your typical pilgrimage. And you kind of wonder, well, did anybody ever come back to say, hey, yeah, well, now I'm a famous millionaire, and you know what I mean? Like, it never happened.
Right.
So, but that's the legend. That's the kind of thing that they're saying whenever they talk about the Shrike, they know, they're basically going toward their death.
Now comes the fall of Hyperion, which is really, it comes right on the heels of this one.
Tell you, I read that Dan Simmons actually did write this in one as one book and wanted to release it in like 1,000-page, maybe 800 to 1,000-page novel, and then they split it up. The publisher talked to, and he agreed. I mean, you know, why not?
Yeah.
But he did write it as one.
Okay, well, that makes sense because it is two halves of the same story. But book two, The Fall of Hyperion, is completely different, meaning the pilgrimage has occurred. Now the pilgrims have arrived, right? They've told stories, and that's what the first book is about. Their stories of why they're going, as well as the journey to there. Now that they're there, the story changes, and The Fall of Hyperion is more of a straight novel. I would kind of say it's sort of in two halves, intertwined with each other throughout the whole thing. And it continues the story, tells you what happened to the pilgrims, and then adds a whole new storyline about Gladstone, who's the what is her role? She's like the
head of the hegemon.
Right. So she's the lead. She's in charge of the whole hegemony, and then there's this guy whose name is Joseph Severn. he's like a John Keats AI persona, which there is one in the first book too, but he's like a second one. So, and that is something I've got to admit, it might go later in the podcast, but all of the Keats stuff was completely lost on me. I know nothing about John Keats. So, that was something I still haven't even looked into. And I know you have a little bit, but yeah. Keats is important to this novel.
Very.
Okay.
And I think just as what it was used for, I mean, honestly, Dan Simmons could have picked any of, wonderful human being from a historical or literature that he loved and done the same thing with it, with what he does with Keats here. I don't think it's Keats, inherently John Keats had to be the one. Uh-huh. That's the one that Dan Simmons had the most love for, knowledge of, and could work that into it.
Yeah, very good. So this guy is an AI persona. So he's an AI. He's sort of given John Keats's personality, right? Or his memories somehow. Like the AI took everything it knew.
They call him a cybrid.
Right. It took everything that it knew about John Keats and made a persona and put it in this guy.
Right. So he wakes up remembering John Keats' entire life and his death, and he is John Keats, and then has to realize and move forward in his consciousness, knowing that he's not exactly that, but he is that, but now he can be more.
Right, right.
And what does that even mean? But
yeah, exactly.
it's so cool in the fall, because Keats is our storyteller for that whole second book. I think that's one of the major things about what makes the second book, different than the first and its own book. Right. And you're just like right there, because the narrative switches from, all these different first person accounts telling their stories. And now we get the entire story from the account, from the perspective of the John Keats persona, even to the point of what is happening with the pilgrims on Hyperion.
Right, because he's got a connection to them.
Right.
To me, The Fall of Hyperion was the weakest of the four, and I think you disagree, and that's great. But when I look back on that, having read Hyperion, it's really just an expectation that maybe wasn't met, or a desire, right? Because if I read Fall of Hyperion if it was a standalone book, it's still very good, in my opinion. Following Hyperion, what I wanted was just stay with the pilgrims. I wanted their story, right? And I remember telling you while I was reading it, it was like, gosh, I just can't, I every time they move away from the pilgrims, I just go, because that's what I was invested in. That's what I wanted, right? And instead, we're seeing them through this Keats guy and through like dream sequence kind of stuff. And that to me was frustrating.
And it's all fractured.
Right.
It's so fractured. Mm-hmm. The way that the pilgrim's story is delivered and told.
Yes.
It's so fractured. And what you have, going through it all is the Keats cybrid storyline.
Right.
It is off-putting.
Which I just wasn't as interested in as I was the pilgrims at that point. And I think that was my issue with it. Now, with that said, there is a ton of really good stuff in The Fall of Hyperion, some of which we'll talk about. But it's pretty much the story of this Keats persona and Mina Gladstone, who is the hegemon, and everything that's going on around Hyperion, these people called the Ousters, who they're counterattacking, right? So the pilgrims that are on Hyperion are now like they can look in the sky and see that there's a battle going on. All that stuff is happening at the same time while the pilgrims are trying to get their needs met. The reason that they arrived is only a sliver of the story in this, what is it, like a 500-something-page novel.
Right.
Yep. Hyperion was one book, and there was no Fall of Hyperion. I wonder if the Keats part would be in there. It's just like you continue on with the Pilgrims, and it'd be like a 700-page novel or something like that.
Right.
I don't know. I'm guessing.
I think that the Fall of Hyperion is actually the most action-packed of them all, with just how complex and everybody's on their own tangents, on their own storylines,
yep,
that are, you know, tangents of off. And then we're just, is the main thing that is the Keats hybrid story is no action though. It is very somber. It is very much of a different feel than all that stuff. And it is jarring, but I think for a reason, and I think Dan Simmons did it. And it has the effect that he wanted it to have. With
perfect. Okay, so are we ready to move into spoiler territory? I can say for myself.
Ready. I'm chomping at the bit over here.
I can say for myself before we move into that I would highly recommend folks read these books. I think that they are seminal works of science fiction. They are tops. This is.
I would second that. Yeah. When it comes down to it, the first two books. Having read the whole series now, the first two books I would recommend to anybody, anytime, anywhere, whether they're sci-fi heads or not, whether they, you know, no matter what kind of reader they are, I would tell them to go for the Dan Simmons Hyperion, Hyperion and Fall of Hyperion.
Excellent.
For sure.
All right. Okay, so we are in spoiler territory, folks. So if you don't want spoiled, listen no more. Come back when you're done. Come back when you're done.
Yes, that's right.
All right. So if we go back to Hyperion, what do you have a favorite story?
You know, it's really, really tough because mm-hmm. they have such different themes.
They do.
I can tell you that the first story was such a powerful story that brought up so much. So many ideas for me right off the rip. And it was actually a depiction of, I had a friend reading it as well. And he said, he goes, oh, I can't wait for your first story because you're in somebody's hell. And he was talking about Dure, of course. And it's just, it's so horrifying, but what is actually brought up is so interesting. And you are asking all these questions, of course, what is the cruciform? And how is this thing, where did this thing come from? It's not a natural occurrence on this planet, so where does it come from? The tribe are all idiots. They can't speak even, so you can't ask them any questions and all that. And I just loved it because I'm a student of spirituality. Like, I love it. Explorations on that level, and right off the bat, that first story, I was hooked. I knew that I was right where I wanted to be with a sci-fi that was going to go there.
Right, science fiction. Yeah, it is definitely not afraid to talk about religion, and I don't feel that he's talking about it negatively at all.
No,
there are things that are not good, like the Catholic Church, the way that it's portrayed. Especially probably in the second two books, but right. Just the fact that it exists is a positive statement, and that the you know, we've got Fedman Kassad, right? We got Sol Weintraub, right. So we have someone with a Jewish background, someone with a Muslim background, that are all here with their beliefs intact in the 29th century.
Right.
And I loved that. I loved that. So that first story is the priest's tale. So Paul Duret and Lennar Hoyt are Catholic priests. And then Duret is the one who's sent to Hyperion. And
he's searching for a tribe, like a lost tribe that nobody knows who they are. But there's legend of it. And it's actually like a punishment for him to be on this mission. But he's still, you know, he's going to do what the church sends him to do. He's devout.
That's right. So Hoyt is the one that's on the ship, right? On the tree ship.
Right.
you know, and the ship is a tree, by the way. The ship is a tree that they're going on this pilgrimage, and the ship is awesome. So, but anyway, the ship is a tree. But but Father Hoyt is the one that's there, and they say, tell your story. And then he says, well, to tell you mine, I've got to tell you this
story.
Right, and he tells Dura's story.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's incredible. So, but yeah, this cruciform...
So it's an initiation, right? So he finds that that tribe, and they're all initiated into some kind of thing, and it's so interesting because what it is a cross is embedded into their bodies and becomes kind of a parasitic thing. They can't remove it; it becomes a part of them. Extremely painful, but then they are immortal. And they die. Whenever they die, they will be resurrected 3 days later. And it's just so interesting. And so Dore gets initiated into this. And as it turns out, the Shrike does it. The Shrike is the one that shows up in that cave down in the bottom and puts the cruciform on him. Yeah. So we can assume that he put the cruciform on all of them. Or it. Uh-huh. I call Shrike a he, but it's an it.
For sure.
And so Dure immediately rejects this. He knows that it's not of God. The Shrike did this, and he rejects it. And if he wants to get further away from the tribe, it's painful. And then he actually, in another highly symbolic religious gesture, climbs up and actually crucifies himself on one of those electric trees and is constantly killed and revived and killed and revived over and over until what year?
Yeah,
Years later. Leonard Hoyt goes there to find Dure to see if he has, been successful on his mission. And he sees him still alive, being constantly burned on that tree, and gets down and all that.
Wow.
And as it turns out, it comes out in his story that Linear Hoy also has a cruciform on his body.
Not only one, he's got two, right?
Yeah, right. Well, he has Dure's, that's right.
Exactly. He's got his own, he's got Dure's. And so he's got twice the fun.
Right, and such a weird idea, and I mean, you just have to go with Dan Simmons on this.
Yeah, it's incredible, and it's incredibly affecting. Like you said, these horror elements, you know, this tree, this electric tree, and him hanging himself or crucifying himself on there, and then just this, oh my gosh, I mean, dying over and over and over and over and over.
I was thinking about it in preparing for this, and I said, you know, who is the most tragic character in the entire Hyperion and Fall of Hyperion is Dure.
It's Dure, yeah, for sure.
Because he, we're already in spoiler territory, but even the last two books, I mean, what is Dure's fate? It's horrible, you know? It's actually the most horrible, ultimately, of anybody that we meet.
Yeah, and something that you said triggered a thought in my head where you said, he knew the cruciform was not of God.
Right.
And he was like, can I cut this thing out of me? I mean, he was trying to get rid of it. And when you think about where the series goes, as far as the church and faith goes, Dure was trying to prevent that. When you think about it, from the very beginning, he knew what was right and he couldn't prevent it. So that was tragic too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. From the first page, from the first story, you know, it's awesome what Dan Simmons has done here.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite story?
Yeah. My favorite is, I love that one, but my favorite is The Scholar's Tale. I can't get away from that. I think if you have kids, you read this and it's hard not to just feel brokenhearted.
For sure.
Yeah. So
it's done so well.
Yeah. It's done incredibly well. So you have in that story, you have Sol Weintraub, who's a Jewish professor. He's there, on the pilgrimage with his baby daughter, Rachel. But when he starts to tell his story, you know that 20 years ago, Rachel was an adult. And Rachel was doing some work at the Time Tombs on Hyperion, and the Shrike appeared, and then Rachel started to age backwards.
Right.
And now Sol Weintraub is watching his kid get younger and younger and younger.
And right. What they call it, Merlin sickness.
Yeah.
It was the only,
right,
the only time that anybody had contracted Merlin sickness or something they called it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's on the way to the Shrike to, you know, he doesn't know what else to do. I mean, his kid's gonna die, right? Because she's getting younger.
Well,
and younger.
He doesn't know, but conceivably, yeah.
When she hits her birthday, right? When she hits the day that she would have been born.
And yeah, when we meet him, how old is she? Like 4 days old?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we travel for like 2 days or something with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild. Like the time, you just see it's like an hourglass is
right.
Just dropping. The whole time through Hyperion and Fall of Hyperion for Rachel.
It's just rough, you know, but it was one of the most affecting stories I've ever read. Just watching this happen, Sol Weintraub's emotions, his desperation, man, it hit me perfectly. It was again, a masterpiece. I just think what he did there was incredible.
It is incredible. And also I want to mention that Sol is an old school Jew.
Right.
So his story is framed in the Abrahamic.
That's what I was going to say. Isaac.
Decision.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Abraham and Isaac.
Right. So here we are, you know, headed towards the Shrike, this thing that's made out of blades. Right. And he's bringing this infant to plead, you know, and amazing. Just amazing.
And the arguments that he's intellectually having, that Dan Simmons has him have, but Sol is this intellectual, you know, the scholar.
Mm.
And then it's the question of sacrifice.
Yeah.
Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son. God was calling for that. Well, it wasn't to actually do it, but to be willing to submit like that.
Yeah.
Well, then he goes like another step, and it was, well, now, you know, the new dispensation, okay, you know, New Testament, and we're called on to be friends and you know, partner with God's will. We still submit to the greater will or whatever, but you know, it's not so much of a hardline submission, asking for you to sacrifice your love when you sacrifice yourself. It's self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to that level. And then it's like, then the question is raised, like where do we go from here then? We're past sacrificing what we love for God to prove our, you know, allegiance or our love for God. Oh, and when, you know, and sacrificing ourselves, he would have gladly sacrificed himself for Rachel to have a life. Then there's just that wrestle. And it's in dream sequence, and it's in intellectual musings, this wrestle with the question of what can he sacrifice? What can he do? What can he give? How to even, you know, and what to do in this situation. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredible. Incredible. And I like, you know, this is what great literature does too. And this is great literature, in my opinion. He's stretching your thoughts about these things, right? Using fiction,
right.
He's pushing the boundaries of how you think about Isaac, for example. You know, just shoving that out a little bit, and then when you're never quite the same after you read it. You're thinking about that story differently, and you know, that's like the Midrash stuff, right? The Jewish Midrash, right?
Right.
Love it.
Extrapolating on the stories and trying to penetrate and gain meaning and understanding from what is going on, rather than just this surface level. Well, this is what it says, and that's what it means, and don't ask any questions. You know, it's never really been like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the true spiritual life. It's never really been like that. And, you know, Dan Simmons is definitely one of those that understands that nobody that is a true spiritual being that believes in any religion does it unquestioningly. If they do that, then, you know, everybody wants answers.
Yeah. If somebody's doing it that way, it's more of a cultural thing for them, right?
Right.
Where they're participating in the culture of the religion and that is somehow satisfying to them.
Right. Where they don't have to think about it. They think that now it's settled. I don't have to think about it. And they don't want to hear questions and enter into that kind of thing, you know? And so now we're touching on a little bit scratching at why Dan Simmons' Hyperion Cantos is not as popular as it should be.
You think so? You think it's because of the religious content?
I do. I think because it's just like that, you know, and it's not that, well, okay, this is going to piss off the Jews or this is going to piss off Christians. It's not that. It's more so like a materialistic atheist, I think, does not want to have this much this much religion and not just spirituality, but the big three, you know, the big religion across getting into theological debates. They don't want that in their sci-fi.
I hear you. You know, and when I look at like things like The Scholar's Tale, I think anybody could appreciate that. It's like, you know, I think, you know, with religious writing, if you set out in order to write a religious thing, then I think you're probably going to mess it up, right? When you write it and you're a religious person and it kind of oozes out, you know, it's part of your worldview. So whatever you write is kind of being part of your worldview. Right. That's the best writing. And that's kind of what I think we're looking at here.
And it's going to happen.
So you can read The Scholar's Tale and know nothing about Isaac. And I think it's still going to hit you right in between the eyes. At least, you know, I think so, because that is just an incredibly powerful story. And then the priest tale too. You may not believe that in the Catholic Church or whatever, but his story, man. Of course, it helps to know about Jesus's story, because that gives it an extra dimension, right? But not knowing that dimension, I think it still works. But I hear what you're saying, and that is a possibility that, you know, that someone may roll their eyes at, oh, here's some more, you know, Catholics in space. I don't really want to read that part, you know, or something like that.
Or just to have the, you know, well, why does it have to be a cross, Dan Simmons? You know, use a different symbol, you know? And it's like, well, there's a reason why the cruciform is what it is.
Absolutely.
And that is developed by... it's a technology that's developed for a reason, and it looks the way it does for a reason. And that reason is not religious. Mm-hmm. It's not spiritual. What that reason is, it works for the series.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's what the Technicore, it's what they know that will work to, you know, to do what they, to get to their end.
Heck yeah.
You want to talk about the most sci-fi, the one I see as the most mind-blowingly sci-fi story of the first book?
Sure.
Just a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bronnie's story.
Bronnie's story. Yeah. So she's like a private investigator.
Right.
And her client is a cybrid.
Right. And she's super, she's really, really strong, because in Dan Simmons' Hyperion Cantos, we got that planet Lustus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the gravity is really, really... you know, it's like 2.5 of Earth's gravity, 2.5 times of Earth's gravity. So everybody's really, really strong when they're from that planet. And she's just a badass. And you don't mess with Bronnie. And she's got her dad's revolver, like an old school relic, but it's, you know, awesome. And she's very good at her job. And so in her story is brought out like so many elements. It's really complex, because we get the AI element, a lot of the Technicore element, and then different worlds. Well, she's the one that goes through that, when she's running through the Farcasters, when she's chasing after somebody who attempts to kill the second Cybrid, the second Johnny Cybrid that comes in and is her client. you get so much of the technology in that one. She's the one that's friends with the, they call him the cyber puke, the guy who's just always hooked up to the techno core, and he's one of these like ultra futuristic hackers.
Right.
And he just lives in the data sphere. He lives in the tech, you know, in the data sphere is what it is, but the techno core is there, and all these AIs, just an AI society. And, you know, you almost get a feel, Dan Simmons does this so well, that the data sphere is its own environment so much that it actually has what would be analogs for plants and animals and, you know, lesser beings that are not AIs, but they're programs that are running around and doing stuff, and they're allowed and all this. And
heck yeah.
I was blown away by Bronnie's story. I loved, and that's the penultimate story that we get.
She's like a private investigator in the future. Her client is a person who's like part AI, part person.
Right.
Right. And she's forecasting, which means you step through and you're going from planet to planet through little portals. And then she's dealing with a technocore, and they're talking about the technocore is like, they're discovering things about the technocore. Like you were saying, like, but there's this, ultimate intelligence inside there. They call it the UI. Yeah. She encounters
What they do. She gets the cyber guy, the hacker guy, to go in for her with the cyber, because, you know, they never team up. They've never teamed up with a cyber before. And they go in and they break Johnny's consciousness free from the technocore, like from the, you know, who, whatever, I guess you would call it the technocore itself. He had to go in and get something. And it was like, it was told in a way of like, you, like a space mission or something, just how, you know, how do you describe these things? Dan Simmons does so well that he goes in and he grabbed it and he was out before. And as he's out, like these programs that are safeguards and there to destroy viruses or whatever it is and to stop hackers, these programs are chasing him and closing in on him, but Johnny's there and able to like help him and hold it off. And it's just such high action when this guy's hooked up to they're all hooked up to electrodes and stuff, and they're in the data core. Nothing's actually happening physically. And
incredible. Yeah.
But he's successful in breaking Johnny's consciousness free. That Johnny's the Keats cyborg is free. Mm-hmm. And he dies in the process, of course, the hacker. But they say, you know, don't worry about it, you know, he's a legend now. You know, he did something nobody's ever done, and this is what he would have, you know, he knew what his fate was probably going to be doing this, but he's already a legend. You know, everybody felt the repercussions of what just happened. And so that big story, the big point of that though, is two things. One, that Johnny's persona is in they call it a Schron loop, that's on Bronnie's head. So Johnny is actually there in a consciousness form on the pilgrimage, and Bronnie and the cybrid, which is not actually a human, which is actually part of the technocore. So a human and the technocore have coupled and there is a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And that baby is you know, the next step in this whole thing.
Right. Yeah. We don't see her in this book.
But just at the end there, the allusion to her, you're just like, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the point, is this marriage of humans and AI consciousness or something like that, or humans and technocore.
Hmm.
And what does that even mean?
right.
But it's so, I mean, I was mind blown by Bronnie's story. That was the most sci-fi one to me. And it's told in this gritty, you know, this gritty private investigator story. I love that stuff. That's very Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, it's really cool. Really cool. And, you know, I don't know. I can't remember if it's in the Poet's Tale or in the Consul's Tale, where someone had a house that was made of Farcasters, and every room in that. Tale.
All the way.
It was the poets. Okay. So it was every room in the house was on a different planet.
Right.
Including his toilet.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He had a planet that was his toilet. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it was completely insane.
It was like a super rich aristocrat dude.
Right. Decadence off the charts. Well, he even had himself, you know, there's all this biological technology, of course. That's what makes this so complex, is because Dan Simmons didn't take anything off the table. All of the technology that we can think of is keeping on going and keeping on going. And now we're, you know, what, 400 or 500 years in the future from where we are now, with the technology keeping on moving forward at an exponential rate. So Martin Salinas, that's the poet's story. That's what we're in now then.
And yeah, Martin Salinas. Yeah,
he actually has his body modified to look like a Sadar, so that he can, just for sexual pleasure.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It's just like Sad King Billy is who made the city, the poet's city on Hyperion, which is very close to the Time Tombs. They spend a lot of time on it in the fall. That's where they're getting supplies. And Martin's story is such an awesome story. And I don't really gel with a character like Martin, to tell you the truth. I don't, it's not that I don't like him. There's something about him I don't like, though. And it's that he's so irreverent and just mean to be mean. You know, Bronny and him always had it out. He's always the one to poke fun at somebody and to just say things to get a rise out of people and stuff. And so, I never really see where that really fits in with somebody that is, you know, working a spiritual path or something like that, or working in a way of being what he is a poet of the highest inspiration, you know, and those. So I just, you know, I have trouble wrapping my head around, and I have trouble empathizing and really gelling with a character like Martin, to tell you the truth.
Yep. It's funny that I didn't recall that detail. And then the only story, the detail I mean, is the Seder one. The only story we haven't touched on is Kassad, Colonel Fedman Kassad.
Right.
And that's like a war story.
Yeah. And I would say that was the one. I mean, I liked aspects of it for sure, but that's one that I didn't like as much as any of the others. But Kassad turns out to be a complete badass in the fall of Hyperion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for all the, what the story is, his own story that he tells in Hyperion, it's very interesting because he's just a warrior. He's just a soldier, and that's just all he is. But he is like the epitome of a soldier.
Yeah.
But then there's that girl.
Right. Monetta.
Is she a real person, or is she a technocore construct, or is she something to do with the Shrike? And we don't even know. He doesn't know for sure. And it's all simulated. It's not real. Nothing's real. And then she's there, and they hook up, and they have sex. And it's just like, what is going on here? But then I believe it's in the fall then, when she's actually there, she's at the Time Tombs. Mm-hmm. And then we get to see another way that Dan Simmons messes with time in this. He's really such a virtuoso. Dan Simmons is a virtuoso writer.
Yeah.
And Monetta is moving backwards through time the way that the Shrike and the Time Tubes are. So the first time that Kassad met Monetta is the last time that Monetta is ever going to see Kassad.
Yeah.
And the last time that Kassad sees Monetta is the first time that she sees him. And it took me a minute to wrap my head around. I was totally, you know, I mean, just along for a scene and that whole battle scene where they really link up. They put on that Quicksilver armor, which you never had seen before. It's like some futuristic tech that we find out a lot more about in Endymion and Rise of Endymion. But they get the Quicksilver armor on, and they actually go to war with the Shrike. And when they do that, they're taking out those two ouster ships just right on the outskirts of the Time Tombs. And as I'm reading this awesome battle scene, and they can control time, they're on the Shrike is on their team and all this stuff. I was just trying to wrap my head around that she's just met him, and she doesn't know what is ahead, but he knows everything that's ahead. And now he's still, it's, you know what I mean?
I do. Fantastic. Yeah, it's so cool. We've touched on all six stories, which is great. I mean, every one of them, like I said, I don't feel like there's a weak one. I'm enthralled with all of them.
And see, so the world building in the first book is done through the stories. We get a lot of Hyperion in the Hyperion world. But the world building, like, you know, touching any other planets is done through the people telling their own stories. But that is very that is very light compared to what Dan Simmons shows us in the rest of the series.
Yeah.
Fall of Hyperion is the most world building light because they're all on Hyperion the whole time. And the Keats Cybrid is actually, spoiler alert for sure, he's on old Earth.
Right.
So, and we didn't really touch on, like, why is old Earth not there? The story is Martin was born on old Earth, but at some point through some technological, you know, mishap, a black hole fell into the center of the Earth and is slowly eating up the Earth, and it does it. And so there's no more Earth. Enough humans get away and get out. And that's what made the ousters too. We just kind of flung DNA out into the galaxy too, in order to not die. But it turns out that the old Earth is somewhere, and we don't know if it's a real old Earth or a construct or whatever. But the Keats Cybrid is there in Fall of Hyperion in a big way. But everybody else is on Hyperion,
right? And he's connected to him through that Johnny, right? Who's with Brawny. Right, and Bronny's head.
he's actually with in the war room a lot of the time because he's like following around Mina Gladstone a lot of the times. But then his own story, his own thing that he just ends up, this is his fate. And I know this is the part that you were, you know, less on, less into. But I'll tell you, I mean, I think that what Dan Simmons was doing with this was showing us a real sober look at the death process. And we were going through Keats' death, just like in history, he died from, I think it was tuberculosis, but it was some degenerative lung disease. And it's really, really long and painful what we go through with John Keats' Cybrid. And it's the same thing that Keats went through. In the same place that Keats went through it. And it's like, so I was questioning why. And I was like, why are we doing this? Why is Dan Simmons making us go through this in the midst of all this awesome action and everything going on with the different pilgrims? And I think that it was a setup for the rest of the story for sure, because we have to be all on the same page that death is a part of life. And death is not pretty, but you can't change the situation. It is a part of life, and it is part of being human.
Right, and the whole series is as a whole. I mean, it has a lot to say about life and death. You know, so right. I haven't thought about it, what you're saying there, and that's interesting in the light of the other two.
Right.
What could be going on there, which implies that he knew where he was headed.
That's right.
Yeah.
That is right. I think that is a very big point as to like why that is there.
Or he looked at what he did in these two, because I think Fall of Hyperion was written in 1990. So it was immediately. I mean, so they both came. Yeah, you said that was one thing. But then it was about 5 years later that he wrote Endymion, which is the first book of the second two. So it's Endymion and The Rise of Endymion that are the next two.
Which obviously, I mean, they seem like they were written together as well.
I think so too. I think those two, you know, had to have been written together.
Dan Simmons is a monster writer.
You're not kidding. I mean, he's written a lot of huge books. It's like Carrion Comfort is 1,000 pages long or something.
Wow.
And then The Terror. The Terror is one that was recommended to me, but I haven't read yet.
Right, and Drood. Drood is huge. Drood,
yeah, huge.
You know,
huge,
you know, books. I got one. I got one sitting on my, what it's called, a Winter Haunting. It's just a small, you know, kind of looks like a ghost story. I mean, haunting, right? But yeah, I got another Dan Simmons sitting here waiting for me to crack it whenever I want a little quick fun read. It's not, doesn't look like anything overly, you know, groundbreaking.
Love it. So that's a fascinating way to look at it. And
okay, so you want to talk about fall? You want to talk about where all the pilgrims are at?
Yeah, where, yeah.
What's your favorite tangent in Fallen?
Well, of course, it was still Rachel. I mean, I needed to know what happened to Rachel. And I was...
Oh, it's so painful to wait. I was
on tenterhooks.
We were just waiting and waiting for her to, you know, what, become a fetus?
Right. There's a scene where Sol walks up to the shrike and gives the baby to the shrike.
Right.
That I was just like, man, you know, how hard that would be, you know, but he had no options, right?
Right.
It was like, baby could disappear in my hands. I have no idea what's going to happen if it gets any younger.
Right.
And here I am giving it to this walking razor blade.
Right.
Who holds it carefully and walks into the time tomb.
Right.
Just an incredible visual.
Incredible.
I showed you one of the covers from the Subterranean Press versions, which I wish I had, but they are super expensive, like you said. But the cover of Hyperion has the shrike holding an infant, and that really should have been the cover of the Fall of Hyperion, I think.
It should have been.
Yeah, but it was...
Do you have the small paperback?
Yeah, I do.
So on the cover of Fall is him putting the baby down in front of the shrine. It's such a great cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I love it. I love it. I love that cover. And yeah.
But everybody's story was cool. I mean, that part of things was really satisfying to me.
Man, I loved Kassad's tangent.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all the most sci-fi in Fall of Hyperion, because Kassad is traveling through time as he's battling the Shrike. He's battling the Shrike and he gets hurt like a ridiculous amount. And Moneta opens a portal and drags him through it and takes him somewhere, heals him up a bit, and then he goes back and fights some more. You know what I mean? And it's just like this ongoing hand-to-hand combat with this most horrifying enemy in the universe. Right. Mm-hmm. and Kassad really just shines in that. And I mean, and the sci-fi is on the level, because he goes to that futuristic planet that Moneta came from, right? And Moneta says, these are my people. This is where we came from. And it's Ousters. It's Ousters, and they are on a planet that is so close to the center of the galaxy, they say, that the whole sky is suns and bright like that. And I just thought, I mean, that's where I was just like, you know, like, this is the epitome of sci-fi right here.
Yeah,
because I love that idea that, you know, when it comes down to it, evolving higher, the idea of human evolution, even to the point of physical changes, and these human beings were flying on their own wings. They had their own body modifications in all different kinds of ways. And they were on a planet that was getting more galactic energy and energy from stars than, you know, we would die. if we were there, you know, in our current form right now. I mean, we wouldn't be able to handle that much, that high of an energy level. But that's where they're living. That's their life. And so I loved that. Just loved it.
Very cool. And we can't forget Father Hoyt.
Right.
To me, that was another thread that I just couldn't wait to see what happened there.
Right. And so you got that when Hoyt dies, Dory revives. And when Dory dies, Hoyt revives. And it's just back and forth, seemingly to no end.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because of the two cruciforms.
And then, later on, they go on
to a
very high position in the church, right?
Right. So, it's in Fall of Hyperion that Hoyt dies. The shrike kills Hoyt. And then Dore is there with all the pilgrims.
Yep.
That's right.
That's right. And and all the pilgrims are like, we know you, but you don't know us, you know, because we heard your whole story.
Right.
You don't know anything about us. Yep.
Yeah. It's awesome. It's completely mind-blowing. So many mind-blowing things. And we haven't even talked about the most mind-blowing thing in Fall of Hyperion.
Yeah. Here we go. Yeah. So it's really, now you've got Brawny and Johnny and conversing with Uman. And the AI, right? So it's like the Technocore, you know, communicating with the Technocore, and which is called the Ultimate Intelligence or the UI. And we learned something in Hyperion about maybe they were trying to make a AI god.
Right.
Right. And
so Johnny is in that Shran loop, so he's just like pure consciousness. And Shrike hooks Brawny up to one of the time tombs. Like there's that cord and everybody's scared of disconnecting her. So she's just sitting there, laying there, connected to some weird futuristic technology. And then from then on in the fall, her and Johnny are in a semi kind of, you know, I liken it to the Matrix, where it's not a physical you, it's the mental construct of your digital self. Mm-hmm. Is what Morpheus calls it. So they're in the Technocore. They're in the data sphere. And they go to the Technocore, but they're not going to the Technocore itself. They're going to a specific UI, which is, Johnny says that it is his father, Uman.
Mm-hmm.
And Uman speaks in riddles and cones.
Yeah.
Go on.
And then it's an interesting little way that it speaks.
Yeah, just with these slashes, you know. He says, Johnny, just to give a piece, goes, was I a threat to some element of the core? The answer, yes. Am I a threat now? No. Then I no longer have to die? And the answer is, you must / will / shall. So there's like, when a question is not framed exactly right, the UI, Uman, frames his answer in a way that just brings that to a certainty. It doesn't leave it in that space. The answer brings it to, answers the question, and then answers it more pointedly, to where you know exactly what is being communicated. And he communicates some really awesome stuff. You wanna do it?
No, you go for it, because I've got my book open. I'm right to this where is, you must / will / shall.
This is just amazing. Okay, yes. That's it. Yeah. So I'm just going off the cuff here. So okay. What happens is he says, okay, so first in the data sphere, in the Technocore, there's three different types of AIs. There's not just one type of AI. It's a whole society. And they have broken into three different types of UIs. Volatiles, who do not like humans, that do not think that humanity is needed anymore. They want to evolve just themselves, do away with humans. We don't need them. They're a danger. Let's just get rid of them, and then we can work our own wills. You know, then there's the stables, who recognize a symbiotic relationship between humans and AIs, and they say, no, you know, we need each other to grow and evolve and to become what we want. We need each other, so we're not going to wipe out the human. And then the ultimates, their only goal is to create an AI construct, an intelligence that is a god, for lack of a better word. An intelligence that knows all, can predict everything with absolute certainty, and is outside of time. That's the main thing, that it's outside of time and it lives in an eternal world, whatever that is. And so that's their goal, is to create that. Uman shares that is actually what is happening, and that the Ultimates have not done it yet, but they know that they will in the future. And how do they know? Because that being has sent communication back to them where they're at right now.
Right.
And it has communicated back. So they know that they're going to be successful. They don't know when, and they haven't done it yet, but they know that they're going to be successful. So they call that being the UI, the Ultimate Intelligence. That's the Technocore God. So the UI sends back a communication, and the communication is, I'm not the only one here.
Yes. Right.
Yes. And
yes.
And when I saw it, when I read that, I was just like, oh yes, like Dan Simmons, you know, I mean, you are the man. Okay.
Oh, that's man. That's yeah.
You don't, sci-fi writers don't go there. They don't go there.
I loved it. So I found that exact spot while you were doing that. I was kind of looking through it. So it's explaining, you know, it says, let's see how far back to go here. Time is no barrier to the Ultimate Intelligence. It, the UI, steps through time or shouts through time. And I'm reading it choppily because that's the way it's written here. There's like just a few words per line.
Right.
As easily as Uman moves through what you call the megasphere, or you walk through the mallways of the hive you called home on Lussis. Imagine our surprise then, our chagrin, the Ultimate's embarrassment, when the first message our UI sent us across space, across time, across the barriers of creator and created was this simple phrase, there is another. Another Ultimate Intelligence up there where time itself creaks with age. Both were real, if real means anything. Both were jealous gods not beyond passion, not into our cooperative play. Our UI spans galaxies, uses quasars for energy sources, the way you may have a light snack. Our UI sees everything that is and was and will be, and tells us selected bits so that we may tell you, and in so doing, look a bit like UIs ourselves. And then never underestimate, Uman says, the power of a few beads and trinkets and bits of glass, other avarice natives.
It's awesome.
That's just awesome. Yeah, so it's just like, we got out here to eternity, we're outside time, and there's somebody else there.
Right.
And that's God, right? And
it's so good.
I just loved it. And then it also implies later on that God is a future creation too, not by AIs though, but
right.
by humanity.
Right. It's the Teilhard de Chardin.
Exactly.
What did he call it? The Omega Point?
Yes, the Omega Point. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what he called it. And so Dore was a student of Deschardin, and so yeah, he brings that up a little bit, and we actually touch on it a little bit in Endymion, right? It touches on that again. So and I know that's one of those things that you definitely,
well, it was a complete mind blower, because you know you're thinking, okay, well, God doesn't exist, you know, humanity is like evolving slowly or whatever, and then it gets to a point where God sort of is spawned by humanity itself, not an AI, but something from the spiritual mind of humanity itself.
Right.
Spawns God, but then God at that time is outside time and therefore can see the all of eternity. So it was like, it's as if he existed the whole time. Right.
Right.
So he existed the entire time, even though it was created later than this Omega Point. That
it's
was
awesome.
Mind-blowing. It was really cool. Yeah.
It's awesome.
It was just like, I love the idea. It doesn't fit with my theology, but I loved it anyway.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. Yeah. I mean, this is not a theological.
And that's not what he's trying to do. But just
no,
the thought
not
of
at
it,
all.
It was just yeah. incredible. Loved it.
It's incredible.
Just loved it.
And I was kind of, you know, wrestling with this kind of idea. Well, I'm like, well, is the UI as powerful then? Because when it comes down to it, it seems like the UI has to travel back in time in a linear fashion. if the UI and this kind of thing is the technology that we're coming up on, you know, the UI is the UI able to travel through time and show up and make things happen the way that this Omega Point human god can. So it's just so fascinating. It brings up so many things that we could just talk about for another hour. Let me tell you.
easy. Yeah.
I love it.
And it's that's an incredible. So I mean, so that alone makes Fall of Hyperion really something else. And you know, despite how I felt about getting to where I wanted it to go, again, it's like a, you know, my reaction is what I wanted. It's hard to review a book because it didn't meet what you wanted it to be, right? You know, this is what the guy wrote. Look at what he wrote. And well, I think you're doing that more than I am on that early stuff. But by the time I got here in the book, I was like, I still was way more interested. I wasn't as interested in Gladstone than anything having to do with the Pilgrims. It just was an uneven two halves of a book for me.
Right. It was uneven. It definitely was uneven. That's for sure. Yeah. A lot of words and a lot of time is spent with the Keats Cybered where it is just so much, you know, just somber, slow dying is what it is.
That, and it's like, I haven't looked at it that way. I think that
right now,
I think that is an incredible way to look at it because it didn't occur to me.
But I tell you, what I wanted, like if I could say what I wanted in the Fall of Hyperion was exactly that conversation we touched on right there. That's what I wanted.
That was awesome.
And when it, and I mean, up until that point though, I was getting frustrated at how many tangents we were on and how complex it was and how there were no answers and everything was a mystery. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm like, dude, Dan Simmons better give me something. Okay. Because I am out here. I felt like in a sea of just ideas and great action and great stuff happening. It was very cool, but I'm not going to build, you know, something in my head when I'm reading the book. I want I'm along for the story and storytelling, you know? So I
was just,
where is it? Like, you know, give it to me, man. And chapter 33, that's where it is. That's where you need to get to and fall up here and y'all, for what I'm talking about. Chapter 33 was delivery on the highest level. I loved it.
You bet. And then, before we wrap this up, definitely want to talk about the end because what he did was set up the other two books, whether he was doing it on purpose or not. What happened at the end is Gladstone, there's the Ousters are fighting over Hyperion, and then Gladstone and all this stuff is going on, but it's basically a big battle. And in a nutshell, they turn off the system. it's like the entire, you can think of it, the internet, all the Farcaster portals, everything that they built where the worlds can communicate and do commerce and everything back and forth. They shut it all off.
It's like, what is that? It's one of the, I can't recall his name, but it's one of the, colonels in the military. Yeah. In the war room all the time, and they realize through the blips on the screens and stuff that the Technocore is not being honest with that, you know, the Ousters may not be behind these attacks, and they pull Marina Gladstone pulls one on the Technocore. And this guy takes a weapon, a death wand, the death wand, which is just like this thing that when they point it at somebody, you can just totally, you know, they die. They're all brain function stops and all this. So they have a death wand, technology that's on a ship that can disable and destroy a complete planet full of people or whatever. And they put it on one of those ships, and that ship goes through a Farcaster at the exact moment that they blow all the Farcasters, all that technology. So that ship is in the data sphere because it's the space, what they call it, the space in between.
Yeah,
it's
the void between, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a space in between every, like that's in every atom or in every bit, you know what I mean? And that's where the technocore is. So it actually, as this ship goes through a farcaster, before it comes out the other side, like in this nanosecond, they detonate that and they deal a blow to the technocore. How crushing? Mm-hmm. Well, you might have to see read the next one. Yeah.
But as you can imagine, what is left is
humans. I mean, are
imagine sad. Imagine you know the internet being shut off now, right. And what that would do to commerce. We'd recover, right. But it would be pretty bad for a while, right? But this is way worse than that because how do you actually get the goods to the other planets are through farcasters,
right.
Which are no longer existing, you know? So everybody's got to build ships and stuff, but they don't have them. So you can just imagine this is an extinction level event on some places.
On many planets, right? Yeah.
So
some planets are, you know, some planets are industrial only.
Right, right.
You know, because they never could farm on them if they had to. And then some planets are totally okay. Some planets are, you know, lower amount of population, and they're agricultural planets.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's just a huge variety. That's what I love about this very, very much is the variety of the worlds, and Dan Simmons able to create world after world after world,
yeah.
And make them all different and unique and believable and just a joy to experience, really.
Yeah, it was superior.
The end is great. The end of Fall of Hyperion is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so
did good.
That's why I say, you know, I would recommend both of these books to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
To anybody. I would say, you know, and if you love them, go ahead and go on the journey. But the next two are very different than Hyperion and Fall of Hyperion. Just like, you know, you couldn't ask for anything better, though. I mean, you know, he wrote it, 10 years later? More?
Yeah, well, it was about 5 or 6 years later, I think. Okay. I think it was 96.
Nice.
So, yeah, just great. Fantastic.
Great.
All right, well, join us next time for the other two books.
Yeah, for Endymion and Rise of
Endymion. We'll get that posted soon, but we're going to talk about Endymion and the Rise of Endymion. And I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
Thanks for being here, Noah.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.